Okay, as Sarah mentioned, my name is Dr. Charlie Hall, Texas A&M University. I'm holder of the Ellison Chair in International Floriculture, and I am an economist. But please don't hold that against me. I'm okay in spite of that. We're going to talk about the economics of water use this afternoon, which is a very interesting issue because, as Bridget well knows, in certain areas of the country, like the whole Great Lakes region, water is very plentiful. And when we talk about water-related issues in terms of water scarcity, the folks just, their eyes start rolling in the back of their head. You know, they don't relate to that. But in my neck of the woods in Texas, of course, that's a daily part of everyday living. So if you look at the whole issue around water, it can be summarized in a very complex mathematical equation. And it goes like this. Zero water equals zero horticulture, period. Right? You ask the 31,000 jobs in the state of Georgia that were lost when the drought in 2007 across the southeast basically prompted the governor in the state of Georgia to declare a water moratorium on all landscapes. Right, and there were a couple of people jailed for watering when they weren't supposed to, and that caught a lot of the media's attention. And so when you think about 31,000 jobs and the impact that has, you have folks like Pike's Nursery in the Atlanta metro market that had defined lawn and garden retail activity for well over three decades in that metro area, out of business within a year, because they simply could not pay all the vendors and at the same time pay for all the capital investment that they invested in building yet more facilities. They were up to 23 different facilities around the metro area. So this has just been a case study example showing the importance of water. And, of course, in California, obviously the cost of water has increased dramatically. And if you look at water, it's a resource that is a conundrum, because most other commodities, there is a market that is fairly definable. And if you talk about the underlying economics, truly supply and demand do work, and they work effectively in allocating those scarce resources. However, in the water market, it's an imperfectly competitive market, and water, believe it or not, even in places like California, is vastly undervalued. And so since you have an imperfect market for water at play, you have the perfect situation for the tragedy of the commons, John, which, harking back to your European roots, the tragedy of the commons was when the farmers were herding pasturing their sheep, and there was only so much pasture land to go around. If one particular sheep herder were to overgraze certain areas, it would be to the detriment of others. So collectively, it came to this agreement, we will not overgraze, period. We will not overgraze. And yet, those lands were still overgrazing, if that's a word. They were still overgrazed. And it's because one farmer thought, well, I'll let my sheep go a little bit longer and they'll... No, I'm just one farmer out of the dozens that are in the area, so that won't make much of a difference. It's the same issue with water. And we have these supply and demand from a demand standpoint. We look and we point fingers at agriculture. We point fingers at municipal use of water. But who, by far, just like pesticides, who, by far, is the biggest user of water and misuser of water? It's the consumer, right? And yet all these fingers get pointed at all these other alternative uses of water, and yet that's what makes the importance of the consumer-related research and how we can influence attitudes and behaviors at the consumer level. That's really going to make a difference, because ultimately, when there's a choice that has to be made between watering people or watering plants, the people will win every time. And when we're making those, when leadership, state legislatures and so forth are making decisions about where to place those valuable water resources, that decision has to be made. Just because plants are pretty is not going to be enough of an argument to convince them to allocate water to horticulture. So again, some of the economics driving the whole concept of water usage and water allocation is underlaid by behaviors and attitudes, or attitudes primarily, regarding water. And so that's what we have to influence, and I think that's the importance of this particular project. Now, there are a number of different methodologies that have been at play in terms of the literature. If you do the literature search regarding the economics of water use, if you go into Hort Science and Hort Technology, the websites, and you do the advanced search, like many of us do for different topics, and you put the economics of water use in there, you'll find very, very, very few publications. And why is that? It's because, again, it's a complex topic, and we look at imperfectly competitive markets, and it's hard to put our finger on exactly what those water costs are, because some places within the country view it as an unlimited resource, and we just keep throwing water using overhead sprinklers. We keep throwing water and throwing water, and versus using very efficient sensor-based drip irrigation or what have you. All right, so there's a number of methods being used to look at this whole water issue. So very quickly, as we go through those, this is not meant to be a table for you to actually read. It's simply a table that's put there for me to remember to tell you about this. So don't bother trying to read this. This is much too small, right? It defies every single PowerPoint rule known to man. However, this is my point, is that Rosa Rodales, who is one of Paul Fisher's PhD students, she's now on the faculty at the University of Connecticut, and she has been looking at this water issue for a long time. And she looked at the cost of filtration systems, and she looked at the cost of sanitation systems. In this particular case, this is one of the tables from the journal article that she published, and looking at the cost of filtration systems. Because when we look at water usage and the application, the efficient application of water within the nursery or the greenhouse, the efficacy of those sprinkler heads and so forth is directly correlated to the filtration system that's used. All right, all of you know that much better than I. So, however, when we look at those filtration systems, we had to find a common unit to be able to measure these costs. And the common unit, we said, was the cost per 1,000 gallons of application. And how much would it cost to use metal screens versus some sort of fiber media versus some sort of sand glass type of filter in which to remove particulates from the water? All right, so you can see that on the right-hand side, if you squint really hard, the costs range from 2 cents up to 17 cents per 1,000 gallons, taking into account the capital cost, and we refer to that as CapEx in the business world, the capital expenditures that it took to install and maintain the filtration systems, as well as the consumables. If it's a paper-based system, it's the paper filters that you have to replace, so on and so forth and so on, and then the labor it takes to maintain those systems. So from that standpoint, this was a fairly unique approach to find a common unit of 1,000 gallons per water applied. And she did the same thing for the cost of various sanitation systems, right? Looking at the water volume that was applied, as well as the capital costs that were incurred in terms of these sanitation systems, whether it was bromine tablets, whether it be calcium hypochlorite, chlorine gas, copper ionization, ozonation, etc. All of those types of systems were looked at, again, from 1,000 gallons of water that were applied. And what was the cost for those 1,000 gallons? And then what would be the annual cost? And those annual costs varied rather dramatically. And now bear in mind that some of these systems were more efficacious than others. And there's some snake oil that's out there and being put forth as science-based that really aren't. And so it ranged from $950 a year all the way up to $170,000 a year for ozonation. And, of course, there's been a lot of debate on the efficacy of ozonation, whether it works or whether it doesn't work. It doesn't matter. But $170,000 is a lot to spend. I mean, I guess it does matter. All right, another study that Bruno's not here right now, but tomorrow, in tomorrow's session, I think he may be the first speaker in that session, but he's in tomorrow's session. And he's going to talk about this particular case study, the Altman Plants case study. And that was published in the Irrigation Science Journal. And in this case, Bruno also looked at the cost per 1,000 gallons, but it was related back to the cost of water. And in this table here, you see the word Western, and that was the Western Municipal Water District and the cost of water in that particular area within California. So Altman Plants was applying water that they were purchasing from the Western Municipal District, and to the tune of $186,000 in some years, $350,000 in other years. And as the drought increased in severity, so did the cost of water, as you might imagine. Supply and demand was actually working in that regard. So the cost of water was rising, and they decided to implement a recycling type of system to be able to mitigate some of that water usage. By doing so, it, of course, added CapEx expenditures, which they offset with several grants that the state of California was offering at the time. So they implemented these CapEx expenditures offset by some of the grants, reducing their dependency on the municipal water, reducing the cost of that water. And you saw the cost savings that, I think it was $350,000 in 1 year, $476,000 the next year. And that's every year thereafter. It just keeps getting bigger and bigger as their capacity to use recycled water increases. That's some big dollars, right? There's a lot of other things you can do with $500,000 in terms of water savings. All right, so in this case, again, Bruno was using the cost of municipal versus recycled water on a 1,000-gallon basis. And there's three other studies I'll allude to. There's another one that our colleague Robin Brumfield was on the economist on that particular project, and that was one that was published regarding recycled water and the cost of disinfection. And in that case, they used a net present value analysis that all the sanitation equipment that was implemented, they took the investment stream, all of the cost over a certain period of time, and minus the water savings over a period of time, minus the cost of application over a period of time, and did a net present value analysis. That was a good approach, because it took into account the time value of money. I'm not saying that, well, I'll just leave it there. That was a good approach. Enough said. Now, John, right there in the center, is your work on sensor-based technology, the use of sensor-based irrigation. And in this case, you use a traditional cost-benefit analysis. And the table there, I've got the benefits, the pumping cost savings, the management cost savings, the annual savings in water relative to the cost of the sensor. And you annualize those costs in much the same way as growers would depreciate those costs over time. All right, so that's anytime if you have to invest $100,000 and that piece of equipment lasts 10 years, then that would be $10,000 a year in terms of depreciation using straight line depreciation. So you annualize those costs. You did the same thing in a sensor-based and found, again, that it was not only efficient, more efficient in terms of applying water, but it was economically efficient to do so as well. So we should be adopting those types of technologies. Now, the third one is from, Bridget, you may remember, Winfei Uva, and she left academia, and she's now farming with her husband along the Maryland coastline. Got some beautiful kids, the riding horseback. She left the rigors of academia, the headaches that have caused this beautiful bald head of mine. But before she left, she did an analysis on zero runoff sub-irrigation systems in the greenhouse. And using that technology, She used a traditional capital investment analysis, much like net present value, looking at the income stream over time and bringing that to today's dollars, but using an economic engineering approach. And that's one of the things that in the S-1065 committee, which was formerly S-1051, formerly S-1021, formerly S-290, formerly S-103, we've used the economic engineering approach for over 30 years in developing our budgets and our cost of production systems. And so that leads me to the analysis that the framework that Dr. Ingram and I have been using for the past several years in looking at carbon footprint and looking at the cost of establishing, the cost of growing and establishing plants in the landscape and taking them out of the landscape, and now water footprint. And this economic engineering approach is basically, as you would surmise it, it's from an engineer standpoint, since we're a horticulturist in the room, we can talk about engineers. They're very anal, if you did not know that before. They're very anal. They look at every single detail. That they're worse than economists and so forth. And yet, we call economic engineering is because we look at every single step in the process, every single activity. You imagine from propagation, the very first propagule that's put into soil or media or what have you, all the way through potting it up into 1 gallon, 3 gallon, 4 inch pot, whatever, all the growing that through, then order pulling, assembly, trucking, cross docking, all the getting it to either the retail buyer or the landscaper, installed in the landscape, used for a period of years. If it's a tree, it may be a 60-year or 100-year horizon. If it's a bedding plant, it may be 6 months, 8 months, or 12 months, depending on what part of the country that you're living in. So you're looking at every single step. And in doing so, you're able to really develop a very detailed cost of production system. And you look at the labor that's involved in producing all those, as well as the materials, and as well as the equipment that's used. That model, Dwayne, has basically been modeled worldwide, and now we refer to it as a life cycle analysis, where we look at really cradle to grave, from the beginning of a product to the very end when we dispose of it. And we cradle to grave perspective, and we're asking ourselves, what is the carbon footprint of all those activities, right? So, or the water footprint of all those activities. Now, why would that make a difference? It makes a difference because there's some 900-pound gorillas that go by the name of Walmart and Kroger and et cetera that are part of a sustainability consortium, and this consortium is sitting right now, perhaps at a meeting of their own, trying to figure out how to put a label on every single product that is sold to consumers with a sustainability label on it. But it talks about not only the ingredients of that particular product, but the sustainable attributes of that product. How much water was used? How much? What's the carbon footprint? Were there any chemicals used? What's the chemical breakdown of the chemical analysis of the product? And so that will happen at some point, and yet we've got to be prepared for that. And so fortunately, we'll have that information. So Dwayne will talk tomorrow more about this life cycle analysis, so I'll leave that for now. But as I said earlier, in this economic engineering approach, we're looking at every single material that's used, every fertilizer, every pest control product. I don't like using that pesticide word anymore. Every single, the media, the container, the label, every single material that's used, every chemical, every single piece of equipment that's used. And more importantly, the cost of operating that equipment, John, whether it be electricity or whether it be gas, diesel, what have you, there's something running that equipment. All right, all that equipment, and it costs money on a per hour basis to run that equipment, and all the energy inputs as well as labor. And here's the tricky one. Now, I've been working on budgets ever since I was a grad student, back in 1984, Right, so I've been doing this for a while. And by far, the most challenging aspect of looking at the cost structure of any particular activity is how much labor is involved. How much time did it really take to perform that activity? And there's been a number of studies where people go out with stopwatches and they measure this particular activity. But there's always the Hawthorne effect, John, where sometimes the Hawthorne electric plant back in the previous century, they lowered the foot candles in their plant to see what the effect would be on productivity of the workers. And they lowered the foot candles to 100 foot candles, Tom. They could barely see the hand in front of their face. And the productivity still went up. That's because the mere fact that somebody's standing there with the stopwatch increased the productivity of all the workers because they were being measured. Right? So we have to account for that, and that's why it's very difficult sometimes to come up with these accurate measurements of labor. And then there's always downtime. How do you account for somebody going to the restroom? How do you account for somebody going to the drink machine? How do you account for impromptu breaks, right? Or you know, a crew that on their way to the next farm in these multi-location businesses, on their way to the next farm, go through the McDonald's drive-thru, right? So how do you account for the lost labor? All right. Now, on this particular table, it's a summary of all the plants, all the different types of plants, and you answered the question. Great. We've looked at a lot of different types of plants. Dwayne actually started this process long before anybody. And he looked at spruce trees, bald and burlap spruce trees, very first. And you notice there's not a cost there. There's the global warming potential, and that's the middle column. And then there's variable cost there on the right-hand side. We didn't get to do the cost for spruce because you did that before we started teaming up. But you can see there's a lot of other categories. We've done red maples. We've done flowering, the deciduous tree, flowering tree. We've done shrubs in the field with looking at viburnum. We've looked at red maples in the PNP situation, pot and pot. And we've looked at hollies, both on the East Coast and the West Coast. And you would think that they would cost the same. It's the same 3-gallon holly, and yet the cost differences are there because of different production systems and different water usage and so forth. And here's another good point, Tim, is that when we develop these budgets, they're wrong for everybody. Right? So we come up with these costs. These aren't reflective of any one particular grower out there because we're utilizing BMPs, best management practices, and everybody's asset the list of assets they have, land, buildings, equipment, plant property, equipment is often referred to, is different. So because of that difference, nobody's cost structure is the same. So this model is a BMP model. Young plants, $25 a tray. Begonias, mums, poinsettias, we've looked at the greenhouse crops. So we've done a lot of different types of crops in these analyses. I'm going to give you an example of begonias. I want to take that very quickly. What's my time like? Oh, I got another 48 minutes. Thank you. All right, so here's the carbon footprint of begonias, right? And you can see these things are 4 decimal points, right? When you put everything on a per plant basis and you look at the carbon footprint, you look at the substrate, you look at the container, you look at the shuttle tray, all the plant growth regulators, all the electricity. We have to carry these things out to the fourth place, the decimal place, in order to measure some of them. Well, what does that tell you? That a lot of these things don't make a big difference. So as you said, we focus in on the things that are going to make a difference. In this case, the substrate, the container, and the shuttle tray represented the most carbon footprint. And if you look at the cost, you look at it's the substrate. It's in this case with the begonia, it's the plug that we had to purchase for about 14 cents each. The container, the shuttle tray, and then the order pulling process. And I've always said, as a rule of thumb, John, that we take 25% of your labors in getting the product either to the field or on the bench. Another 25% in taking care of it when it's in the field or on the bench. 50% of your labor is in the order pulling, assembly, the supermarket system, if you use a lean flow system now, and the loading of trucks and getting it out the door. 50% of your labor is on the back end instead of all through the production system. So when you start talking about how do we make a difference with growers and open their eyes to cost savings, you look at labor, because that's as much as 35 to 40% of their total cost. And then when you break down labor, you look on the back end. It's not whether you fertilize with 12, 13, 47, or 2, 3, 4, whatever. I better use it. 12, 12, 12, or I better stick to my horticulture roots here. Or 12, 6, 18. It doesn't, and the difference in cost may be a half a cent between the two. That's not where you're going to save the money. It's going to be in the labor. And of course, the yellow there is irrigation. And all of the things in terms of the hours spent in making sure that the sprayers, the spray heads were unplugged, making sure that there's the drip irrigation is where it's supposed to be, making sure that, well, the electricity to run the pumps, or the field-grown crops, it was the diesel to run the pumps out in the field. All that equipment used, so for begonias in this case, all that irrigation-related stuff cost $0.0007. Not even a penny. Not even. So when we start talking about making changes and the barriers, if Alexa was here, we talk about barriers, cost is not one of those barriers. Look at how Altman Plant spent $1 million on their system to be able to recycle water and so forth. And yet they're going to get that back within just a couple of years, right? So we talk about these huge investments. No, we got to talk about the benefits of what's going to be coming down the pike. And there's some graphs to tell you what I just told you. So we do some sensitivity analysis, and we address all these what-if questions. What if labor increased to $15 an hour in California, right? Well, it's going to increase cost 2%. Right? Boom, we can analyze that. It's going to be about a $10,000 tax per FTE in the state of California for every business when labor goes up to there. And we know that input prices are going to increase, because this year I did a four-part series for American Hort video series, and I talked about the rising input costs. And since the end of the Great Recession, cost have increased by 21%. That's labor, materials, that's 21%. So if you have cost increasing and prices staying relatively the same or barely increasing, that's that cost-price squeeze I'm talking about, and margin compression. So margin is being eroded out of the industry. Just 2017 over 2016, prices rose by 3.5%. The cost increased by 3.5%. Prices didn't go up 3.5%. Now, this year alone, if you look at transportation, freight rates, right, that's 17% of the production-related expenses. Since June last year to June this year, the freight rate, Lauren, the freight rate costs have increased by 9.5%. Right? So that's, again, that's further margin compression. So what are we learning? Knowing about these the sustainable aspects, the carbon footprint, the water footprint, and the cost, helps us manage more efficiently and utilize those resources more efficiently. A few inputs and processes in the production process account for most of the carbon footprint and most of the variable cost. And, quite frankly, the cost of irrigation hasn't been that big. Ecosystem services greatly outweigh the greenhouse gas emissions during production, particularly if it's a shrub or a tree. For bedding plants, not so much, because the life cycle is so short, but the positive carbon footprint on trees, it's just mind-boggling, Tom. We should be valuing trees according to those ecosystem services benefits. And then lastly, the industry should market this, right? And so through Bridget's work and with a little help from Melinda, we're basically answering some of those questions about what's going to be the best way to market so that folks deem our products, our flowers, shrubs, and trees, to be necessities in their lives rather than mere luxuries that they can cast aside at the next downturn or the next drought. Right? That we're necessities, that we deserve our fair share of water, that we're not water abusers. We're part of the solution to the whole water dilemma that this country faces, right? Because of the benefits of green infrastructure. So with that, I think I'm exactly on time, maybe 30 seconds over. But we have time for one question. Preguntas, por favor. Yes, John. Yeah.
$25 for a tray of bedding plants. How can that be? I mean, they only charge $3 for the thing or whatever. So, they're not losing money on that. So what am I misunderstanding?
Yeah, that was a 72 count tray of spathiphyllum or syngonium. One of those. They're roughly the same cost. So that's a 72 count. Do the math. $25 divided by 72. You're not talking about a whole lot for each individual plant, particularly for a spathiphyllum or a syngonium plant. So again, you got to remember that's a 72 count tray. If it were 4:17 in the morning, I could do that math, but it's 4:17 in the afternoon, dangerously close to happy hour. So I'm just going to let you do the math. All right, good
Thank
question.
You,
Thank y'all.